Hi, everybody. Bob Claster here, and I'm your host for Funny Stuff, half an hour of comedy, which airs every Friday night at this time. And the show you're about to hear is the first of three shows with Peter Cook. And if you don't know who Peter Cook is one of the great comic minds of his generation. He's one half of Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and one fourth of Beyond the Fringe and all sorts of things, all of which we will cover in this interview. This is something I've waited a long time for, and it was certainly worth the wait. Peter looks quite a bit heavier and quite a bit grayer than one is used to seeing him, but there is fire in those eyes, and I think it comes across on the tape. To set up what happens at the beginning here, I just said good evening, and just under my breath I said Sir Arthur. I said, good evening, Sir Arthur. And there's a character that he does of Sir Arthur Strieb Griebling, and just saying that was enough to trigger him off into 3 or 4 minutes of Sir Arthur Strieb Griebling. So before, just in case you're not familiar with that character, before I start, I'll let you hear Sir Arthur Strieb Griebling from the Broadway play that he did with Dudley Moore called Good Evening, and then the interview with Peter Cook.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I'm talking tonight to Sir Arthur Strieb Griebling.
Oh, no, you're not.
I'm what?
You're not at all. You're talking to Sir Arthur Strieb Griebling.
Oh,
you're confusing me with Sir Arthur Strieb Griebling.
I'm so sorry.
Yes, well, my name is Strieb Griebling. The T is silent, as in Fox.
I'm so sorry. I would like to ask Sir Arthur something about his rather unique restaurant, The Frog and Peach.
Well, this seems like an ideal opportunity, really. What with me being here and you being there.
Well, yes, yes.
Wonderful opportunity.
Yes, indeed.
Seize it.
Certainly will. Well, perhaps you would tell us something about The Frog and Peach, Sir Arthur.
Yes.
How, in fact, did the idea come to you?
The idea for The Frog and Peach came to me in the bath. A lot of things come to me in the bath. Many mosquitoes, various forms of water snake. But on this occasion, a rather unique and stunning idea. I suddenly thought to myself, where can a young couple with not too much money to spend, you know, feeling a bit hungry, a bit peckish, want something to eat, where can they go and get a really big frog? A really big frog and a damn fine peach. Where can they go?
Yeah.
Where can they go? Of course, answer came there none. So on this premise, I founded the restaurant.
On these premises, in fact?
On these precise premises, yes. I founded the Frog and Peach.
How long ago did you start this venture?
Oh, that's a tricky one. Certainly within living memory.
Good.
Believe it or shortly after World War II.
Ah, yes.
You remember that, World War II?
Well, certainly, yes.
Absolutely ghastly business.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely ghastly business.
Yes, indeed, yes.
I was completely against it.
Well, I think we all were.
Yes, well, I wrote a letter.
Getting back to the Frog and Peach.
Yes.
How has business been?
Let me answer that question in two parts. Business hasn't been, and there hasn't been any business. These last 35 years have been rather a lean time for us, up at the old F&P.
Well, don't you feel you're at a slight disadvantage being stuck out here in the middle of a bog and in the heart of the Yorkshire Moors?
I think the word disadvantage is awfully well chosen here, yes. This is what we're at. We're at a disadvantage. Mm. Stuck out here in the middle of a bog in the heart of the Yorkshire Moors. But I thought at the time, rightly or wrongly, possibly both, the people in this country were crying out for a restaurant without a parking problem. And here in the middle of a bog in the heart of the Yorkshire Moors, there is no problem parking the car.
No.
A little difficulty extricating it, but the parking here is magnificent.
Yeah.
It is magnificent parking.
Yes, indeed.
Wonderful parking.
But don't you feel you're also at a disadvantage with regard to your menu?
Oh, yes. Yes, we are at a tremendous disadvantage with regard to the menu.
Mm.
Have you seen it?
Very briefly.
That's the only way to see it. I mean, the choice is so limited. We have such a limited choice. There's only two main dishes to choose from. Now, what are they? Last, I should know this by heart after 35 years. Oh, yes, first of all, There is frog a la pêche. Frog a la pêche is basically a large frog covered in boiling Cointreau with a peach stuck in its mouth. It's one of the most disgusting things I've ever seen. The only alternative to frog a la pêche is even worse. Pêche à la frog. Pêche à la frog. A peach is brought to your table by the waiter. Again, covered in boiling Cointreau.
The waiter?
Very often, yes. Very often the waiter is, alas, covered in boiling Cointreau. But the policy here is to aim the Cointreau at the peach.
Yes.
That's the policy.
Yes.
The peach is then sliced open down the middle to reveal, oh my God, about 300 squiggling black tadpoles. It is the most nauseating sight I have ever seen. It's enough to put you off your food.
Yes.
Which is a damn good thing, considering what the food is like.
Yes. If you don't mind me saying, sir, it does seem to me as if the whole venture of the frog and peach has been a little disastrous.
Oh. I don't think I'd use the word disastrous, yeah?
No?
I think catastrophic will be nearer the mark. The whole thing has been a total failure and a huge catastrophe.
Do you feel you've learned from your mistakes?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. I have learned from my mistakes, and I'm sure I could repeat them exactly.
Thank you, Sir Arthur Greenstreet.
Here's my seat.
Good evening.
Sir Arthur.
Oh, good evening, yes. Good grieving. Good grief. Good God. Good.
It's always difficult for me when I was...
Have we begun?
No.
No, we haven't. I just noticed the microphone fell out of the stand there. Well, I imagine that's part of your show business. My mother was in show business, of course. She was... She appeared as a little Robin in Babes in the Wood, in the 40s.
Not one of the babes?
No, she was a small red-breasted... Well, she was red-breasted in real life, which was we found to hush up, but she did appear as a small bird. And it had not a big scene, really. She just had to fly in onto a little table. And my sister played a little bit of bread. My sister lay on the table. It wasn't very realistic, because a bit of bread looks nothing like my sister. And in the original script, it was meant to be brown bread, I think, but in those days, racial prejudice was very strong in the United Kingdom. And so my sister, Thelma, played some white bread, and my mother played a robin who flew in and pecked up. Anyway, it didn't run this show, really, but ever since then, it's been in her blood, the showbiz bug.
And you've inherited it?
Yes, I have the same bug. Well, it's a bud that breeds. in the family. This bug's for you, I remember she used to say, whenever I came home from a hard day chopping wood in the conservatory. But we're a tightly knit family, and one of the lovely things about my mother is her absence at the moment. She's not in the room, is she?
I don't see her.
Her absence is one of her most delightful features.
She's mastered that.
She keeps forgetting to be absent, but when she's absent, she's a joy.
Well, here's to her. I was starting to tell you, it's difficult when
it's slightly difficult. It's awfully difficult. You notice how difficult it is for me to open my mouth, because I've had to train for years. In my early days in show business, for example, I could never do it on cue. The director would say, you know, action. And I was meant to say something, you know, topical, like good evening or, you know, good night, depending on what time of the day it was. Or good morning, for that matter, because we worked all hours, being a showbiz household, collating press cuttings and sticking them on the walls. But my mouth wouldn't open, and I had to have a mouth operative. My brother Dennis used to do that. He used to poke my mouth open with a stick, which would be my cue to speak. And if you've got a stick in your mouth, it's awfully hard to say good evening. But I can do it now, as you can see. It's probably largely due to the tranquilizing drugs which have fed into me.
Good evening.
Yes, good evening. I say drugs, I don't mean drugs. Not in the sense of drugs, but various Navajo folklore woven into long cigarettes. Herbs, as I believe you call them in this country, yes. When you look in the mirror, as I believe you call it. We say mirror and you say mirror for some reason, which I think is an error, or an error, as you call it.
Good evening.
Good evening. Yes, I'm sorry about having to say good evening constantly, but unless I say good evening about once a minute, my whole body seizes up and I fall to the floor, which, as you see, is quite a long way from this chair, I'd say about 2.5 foot. I've never had a head for height, or a bottom for chairs, for that matter, which is why I'm crouched beside you.
Your comedy writing career started well before college.
Well before comedy started, yes.
You had some pieces published in Punch when you were in high school, is this true?
Yes, I'm back to my normal voice. It sounds so ghastly, I think I should probably revert to being rather. Yes, I did. I did have a few things published in Punch when I was at school. It was very nice to see something in print in a national magazine. It was a big thrill to get a cheque through the post for about 5 guineas or...
Have you read those pieces recently?
No, I haven't. I don't know where they are at all. It may all be totally made up. Perhaps I never wrote for Punch at all, but I think I did.
How did you... Then you went to Cambridge.
Yes.
And how did you get involved with the Footlights?
Well, I didn't for about a year. I thought it was a terribly grand organisation that you couldn't join. And then I thought, I'll go and see who's in charge of it. There's a guy called Adrian Slade, brother of Julian Slade, who wrote Salad Days. And he was remarkably nice. And he said, well, do you have any pieces? And I had some solo material, which I did. And he said, oh, come on in, join at once. And it was very easy. It took about 3 minutes. It was very nice. I showed off for the next 2 years.
Right about the time your generation started producing Footlight shows, they became something that they hadn't been before.
I suppose around about my time we did a bit more to do with what was actually going on in the world. Not all that much, but a little bit. And up till that time, I don't think there'd ever been any women in the Footlights Review. There'd always been men dragging up. And Eleanor Bron was in the first review that I was... Mm-hmm. Connected with it. Seemed to make sense to have a woman rather than a man there, of course. I like dressing up as a woman as much as the next man.
there were
I
women
dress up as a man as much as the next woman. I mean, it's no skin off my nose. Who dresses up as what?
So the first really different Footlights show was called The Last Laugh.
That's right, directed by John Bird. And that was had the theme of nuclear apocalypse, I think it was. It was a cheerful little show.
Now, were you involved in that one?
Involved in the writing, some of the writing of it, and I was in it, performing in it. Mm-hmm. And the worst part about it, we had to learn to do some dances, if I remember right, a la West Side Story, which was a strain on the gullibility of any audience to see me dancing about as a jet or a shark or whatever they were called.
Now, a very influential figure in that period was a man by the name of John Bird.
That's right, yes.
That most Americans don't know anything about. Who is he?
Well, even less after this interview. He's a very good director, good comedy actor, good writer. And I eventually teamed up with him again with the club I had in London called The Establishment, which ran for about 4 years. And he was part of the resident cast there. John Bird, John Fortune, Jeremy Guyte, who is now a resident in the States and has been for about 20 years, I think, and Eleanor Bron. We specialised in doing sort of topical political stuff at The Establishment and had a place in New York again for about 4 years. It was at the site of... It used to be the old Morocco, 154 East 54th. And... I thought I'd go and look at the building a few years ago, and of course it isn't there at all. Some gigantic offices have gone up.
Not even a little plaque.
Not even a little plaque saying John Bird et al. We're here. Not a sausage. Yes, he was very influential.
And then the next review was mostly yours.
A large part of it, yes.
Pop goes Mrs. Jessup.
A rather less serious statement about world affairs. The theme of which really escapes me, except that we were the gigantic box which was meant to contain Mrs. Jessup, and at the end of the show she was meant to pop out of the box. I can't remember whether she did or not. I think Mrs. Jessup was a bit of a damp squib. I think she was one of those bloody women who never jumps out of a box when he wanted to. But she provided a rather abstract theme to the show.
So there was a running theme through the shows. They weren't just a loose collection of pieces.
Well, we loosely collected the theme of pieces and then established a very tenuous link by some means or another.
Did any of those pieces, did you carry any of those into later usage?
Yes, a lot of them went into a review called Pieces of Eight.
Right.
With Kenneth Williams and Fenella Fielding.
I have those records, and we can play a piece from those. If you can. What
I
piece?
Can't stop you, Bob. I can't stop you.
What piece are you proudest of?
I can't show me the sleeve.
those I have on tape. My favorite is Interesting Fact.
That's an interesting fact. That you're interested in that fact. It's all about, yes, very, very interesting that you're interested in that, because I was very interested in Interesting Facts when I wrote it, which is an interesting fact in itself, but I don't think Kenny Williams does it in that voice.
Not anymore, at least.
No, death has robbed him of his versatility.
Hello?
Hello.
I think I'll sit down here.
Yes, you do that.
Hello again.
Hello.
Did you know you got 4 miles of tubing in your stomach?
I beg your pardon?
I said, did you know you got 4 miles of tubing in your stomach?
No, I didn't realise that.
Well, you have, in any case, 4 miles of it, all coiled up very tight.
Yes, I'd rather not think about it, thank you.
It has to be coiled up very tight, otherwise they never get it all in. It's interesting, isn't it, how they manage to cram it all in?
Yes, I suppose it is.
Because a special kind of tubing is used. You couldn't get 4 miles of any old tubing in your stomach.
No.
It's called intestines. And it folds up ever so small. That's how they manage to cram it all in. Aren't you interested in your intestines?
Not particularly.
Well, you ought to be, because they're very important. You'd be lost without your intestines. Would you like to see a diagram of your intestines? I've got one here in my little book.
No, thank you very much.
Well, it's not really a diagram of your intestines. Not unless it was you that modelled for it. And it couldn't be you, really, because you have to be dead before you can model for intestines.
Oh, do you?
Yes. So it's not a very good job to have, is it? There you are, you see? You see how far the food has to travel?
Yes, yes, I see.
4 miles it has to go, and it takes 4 hours. That's a mile an hour it goes.
I had no idea.
That means you never get any really fresh food in your stomach. It's all at least 4 hours old.
Fancy that?
No, I don't fancy that, thank you very much. I don't fancy at all. I wish my intestines were shorter. Don't you wish your intestines were shorter?
I wish you'd leave my intestines out of it.
You can't leave your intestines out of it. You wouldn't be able to digest.
Let's just forget about my intestines, shall we?
All right, then. Would you like to hear an interesting fact about Chinamen?
Oh, very well. What is it?
Do you know that if all the Chinamen in the world was to link hands, they would girdle the earth 3 times?
3 times, eh?
Yes. Girdle, girdle, girdle. Because I haven't had time to check up on it, you know. I haven't had time to go around saying, Mr. Wang, meet Mr. Wong, link hands and see if you can girdle the earth. I'm too busy writing all the facts down in my little book. They are very interesting facts in my little book, aren't they?
Oh, yes, I'm fascinated.
For instance, did you know that the whale isn't really a fish at all? The whale is an insect and it lives on bananas.
The whale is an insect? I've never heard of such rubbish.
I know. It's a joke. I just made it up. I was having you on. It's one of my little jokes.
Yes, I see.
What about the grasshopper, then?
Well, what about the grasshopper?
I don't know. Have you heard anything?
Oh.
No, but really, the grasshopper is a very interesting creature. Do you know it has a disproportionate leaping ability due to its very powerful hind legs? And it goes hop. It goes hop, hop, hop all over arable land. That is land where it's actually tilled by Arabs. Oh, and you know, an Arab can live for a whole year on one grain of rice.
A whole year on one grain of rice?
Yes. Oh, no, it's a mosquito that lives for a whole year on one grain of rice. I always get those two mixed up because I've got them on the same page. See, that's mosquito and Muslim.
Quite so, quite.
But it's interesting, isn't it, about the grasshopper's leaping ability. If a giraffe could leap pound for pound as high as a grasshopper, a giraffe could leap right onto the moon and thus lead Britain in a space race. That's an interesting fact, isn't it?
Yes, well, I'm rather bored with all your interesting facts.
That's interesting too, because you know what? I'm Britain's secret boring weapon.
You're Britain's secret boring weapon?
Yes. You see, if there's a war, they put me on an aeroplane, and I'm dropped on the enemies.
Dropped on the enemies?
Yes, and then I bore them all to death. I bore them all to death, you see?
I'm not at all surprised. I've never heard such a load of...
Here, that's only a joke. Here, yes. That's a joke. It's just one of my little jokes. It's not a fact. It's just a joke. Oh, he's gone.
That was the very first piece of British humor that I ever heard. There was a radio station in New York that used to play that when I was in high school, and I used to pester them to play it all the time because it was a record that was totally unavailable over here.
Yes, of all my records, on the whole, totally unavailable over here.
Harold Pinter wrote comedy for those.
They're very good sketches. It used to annoy me because we were paid on a point system, you know, running time of each sketch was added up, and so. And Harold Pinter's always had these stage directions which are filled with pauses.
Just to get more money.
Well, this is my jejeune view of it all. So I wrote a lot of sketches with tremendous pauses in, but nobody fell for it at all.
The money pause, right?
I don't think Harold Pinter was known. He was not putting it in for the money, but
I did think it a bit unfair that there was a sketch called The Last to Go, about which newspaper went was the last to sell.
And that was all the sketch was about, was this old news vendor saying,
sometimes it's the stars, it's the last to go. And other nights, it's the standard.
and on it went, filled with... I'd not done as quickly as that, and far more pauses than that.
Well, I was very frustrated. They put together a record called The World of Kenneth Williams, which contains all of his pieces... from Pieces of Eight and One Over the Eight, except for Interesting Facts.
Well, it's part of the conspiracy to keep Interesting Facts from the world.
I'm doing all I can to...
You're doing all you can.
To fight that conspiracy.
Nobody could do more.
Now, which came first, the Establishment Club or Beyond the Fringe, or did they happen sort of at the same
Simultaneously, time? Simultaneously. I was looking for premises for the Establishment Club for about 9 months prior to Beyond the Fringe opening. So Beyond the Fringe, in fact, opened quicker than the Establishment, so we had to build the Establishment. And the theatres were already there. But they were roughly at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Now, who brought the members together? This was not a spontaneous combustion.
No, a guy who was working as assistant artistic director at the Edinburgh Festival called John Bassett, who knew of me, knew of Jonathan, and knew Dudley and Alan from Oxford, to which university he'd been. And the year before, they'd had Flowers and Swan as a late-night entertainment at the Edinburgh Festival after the Old Vic. And that had gone very well, and they wanted a sort of light-hearted one-hour show. And he brought us all together, and we eyed each other suspiciously in an Indian restaurant. And we all had solo material.
Now, at the time you met... You knew Jonathan Miller?
No, he'd left Cambridge before I arrived.
I see.
But I knew of him. But I knew that he'd appeared on the Palladium show, I think. It had been heralded as the new Danny Kaye. A description that alarmed and depressed him. It probably alarmed Danny Kaye, for that matter. But he was another footlights man who'd entered the wide world of Edmondo Chobiz.
You had heard of Jonathan Miller.
And what I'd heard, I didn't like.
Okay.
Didn't like at all.
And the other two you
talented,
knew nothing of.
Tall, versatile, sickening cornucopia of gifts, which he, yes.
And the other two you
never heard of those two. No, Alan Bennett and Dudley Moore, never heard of them.
Now, did they know each other then?
I imagine so. Isn't he part of the Oxford homosexual circles? They probably bumped into each other in their special green costumes.
So what did you think of them when you met them?
Alan was quite shy. He used to chew his handkerchief. I thought that was a northern characteristic, working-class northern characteristic. I thought they all chewed handkerchiefs, being so short of food or whatever it was.
Those that don't wear them on their heads, right?
Those, yeah, don't wear them on their heads. Certainly never blew his nose in it. He did that always in his lapels of his ill-fitting jacket. And Dudley was rather silent. Let his twinkling fingers do the talking through his deft piano work. Both the working class members of the cast were quite diffident, and Jonathan burbled on about everything in the world, and I was the second most talkative.
You four meet in this Indian restaurant, and it is agreed that it would be a...
Nice to do it for a couple of weeks.
Right, and was it initially done with all pre-existing material?
No, we all had solo bits, and we wrote some sketches jointly, the two of which I remember, which I think were the sort of, certainly amongst the best of the whole show, were the aftermath of war and the Shakespearean parody.
Description of a time when petty lust and overweening treachery offend the ruck of state. Thus fly we now, as off with Phoebus did fair Easterlof, our too proud Flanders court. Where is the warlike Warwick, like to the mole that sat on Hector's brow? Fair set for England and for war!
Welcome to our court, fair cousin Albany, and you, our fairest Essex. Take this, my hand, and you, sweet Essex, this, and with this bond we'll cry anon, and shout, Jack Cock of London to the foe. Ha ha! Approach your ears, and kindly lend your conscience to my peace. Our ruddy scouts to me this hefty news have brought. The naughty English, expecting now some pregnance in our plan, have with some haughty purpose bent Aeolus unto the service of their sail. So even now, while we to the wanton loot do strut, is brutish Bolingbroke bent fair upon some fickle circumstance? Get thee to Gloucester, Wessex! Do thee to Essex, etc. Fair Albany to Somerset must eke his route, and Scroop do you to Westmoreland, where shall bold York, en rooted now for Lancaster, with forces of our uncle Rutland, enjoin his standard with sweet Norfolk's host. Fair Sussex, get thee to Warwick's born, and there with frowning purpose tell our plan to Bedford's tilted ear, that he shall press with most insensate speed and join his warlike effort to bold Dorset's side. I most royally shall now to bed, to sleep off all the nonsense I just said. Is it botched up then, Master Puke?
Marry it is, good snot.
Aha.
'Tis said our master the Duke hath contrived some naughtiness against his son the King.
Aye, and it just confirmed our level.
Yeah.
What say you, Master Snot? I am for Lancaster, and that's to say for good shoe leather.
Come, speak, good Master Snot, or have the leather blocked up thy tongue.
Leather act pretty laced up, good lordship, and laces do good service in a lordly.
Then go trippingly upon thy laces, good snot.
Aha. Leather laces thy undoing, too.
Aha! They should undo many a fair boot this day.
Arr.
Come, let's to our rural revel, and with our song, enchant our king.
Oh, boring old song, boring old song, boring old song, boring old song.
Within our bowels, lock it up. And who comes here that on his face some awful confidence implies some mischief to our royal person?
Welcome, my lord! Unstop your ear and yet prepare to yield the optic tear to my experience. Such news I bring as only can crack open the casket of your soul. Not 6 miles hence there grows an oak whose knotty thews engendered in the bosky wood doth raise itself most impudent towards the solstice sun. So saying, did there die, and dying, so did they.
Oh, God! This was most gravely undertaken. And undertaken is extremely gravely it. Why then, we'll muster and to the field of battle go, and unto them our English sinew show.
Nobly entertained, and so by steel, shall is our contest now be buckled up. Come, sir, let's toot!
Let's toot! Good season, thou shalt thyself in himself, thyself involved.
Fair cousin.
hast done me wrong. Now is steel, twixt gut and bladder interposed.
Well, there you go. That's going to do it for this first third of this program having to do with Peter Cook. That, of course, was Beyond the Fringe, which was Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, Jonathan Miller, and Alan Bennett. And that was a piece that they put together as a group. Later on in the show, in the next part of the show, you'll hear some more pieces of Beyond the Fringe. We'll talk some more about Beyond the Fringe, and we'll get into the work that Peter did with Dudley, including their marvelous television series, which unfortunately has never been seen in this country, called Not Only But Also. But you'll hear so much about it that it will almost seem as if you're seeing it. I hope you can join me for next week's show, which is Peter Cook, and also the one following it, which will conclude the series. And let's see what else is there to tell you. The address is Bob Claster, care of KCRW, 1900 Pico Boulevard, Santa Monica, California, 90405. I was going to do this at the end, but I might as well do it after every show. I'd like to thank David Wilkinson and John Cleese and Jerry Adler and, of course, Peter Cook, all of whom were instrumental in making this possible. So until next week, when we continue with our series with Peter Cook, this is your host, Bob Claster, thanking you very much for listening and reminding you, as always, to keep that sense of humor well exercised, because you never know when you're going to need it. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.